Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Robin Booker talks about weed control in dry conditions. Lorraine Stevenson reveals a new resource that will help you figure out the impacts of climate change on your own farm.
The premise here is that agriculture and individual farms can adapt to climate change over time, but not overnight.
We'll also hear about how Maple Leaf Foods is ridding its products of everything artificial. And Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada takes a look at the markets. That's all on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. In most parts of the prairies, it's a dry and late spring. That has significant implications for weed control, and in a few minutes, Robin Booker will join us to talk about that. We will have a markets update with Dave Sims of Commodity News Service. And we'll hear about how Maple Leaf Foods is ridding its products of everything artificial. But first, how will climate change affect your farm? And I mean your farm specifically. That's a tough question for any farmer to answer, but a new resource is helping to answer it. And Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator joins me now to talk about this. Hello, Lorraine, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Ed.
So, Lorraine, can you give us just a brief description on what this Climate Atlas actually is?
Sure. What it is a free online resource that's brought together scientific data to show the future climate on the Canadian prairies, depending on progress made or not made to bring down greenhouse gas emissions. It was developed at the Prairie Climate Center in Winnipeg. That was launched in 2015 as a joint venture between the International Institute for Sustainable Development and U of Winnipeg. Initially, the aim was to generate some scientific high-quality data that would depict climate change expected to occur within the province. So the provincial climate change branch wanted some data showing what Manitoba's overall climate would look like 30 to 60 years on. And so the Atlas itself has been out for a bit, but just unveiled this spring is a specific section which is devoted to agriculture. So what that piece has done is take the bigger picture of global warming, and it zeroes right into how a hotter overall climate would impact your region or even your municipality.
So, you know, specifically on the agriculture piece, what's in there? What's a farmer going to be looking at if he goes in there and opens that bit and looks for something that would affect his local area?
Yeah, very specific information on anticipated changes on variables such as precipitation, mean temperature, dates of the last spring frost and the first early frost, corn heat units. Everything is based on two scenarios, so you can compare what a really high carbon future would look like versus a very low carbon future. And all of these variables are specific to three time periods. So you can look at the recent past, so between 1976 and 2005 to compare, and then the immediate future of 2021 to 2050, and then the near future of 2050 to 2080.
Have you had a chance to take a look at this yourself?
Yeah, I wanted to see how user-friendly this actually was, and it really is. It's a lot of very complicated climate data that you can easily navigate. You go to the map, you click Find Me, and it'll bring up an entire report. Or you can go under the menu and click on Find Local Data. So I checked it out to see how many really hot days of 30 degrees Celsius or more would be coming in a high carbon future for the Brandon region. So in the past, about 12 days of that level of temperature. In a high carbon future, again, that's over the next 30 years, the projection is for 26 days of 30 degrees Celsius weather, so nearly a month of pretty hot weather. The date for the last spring frost is projected to be May 13th in the immediate future, and October 1st is the anticipated date for the first fall frost. or corn heat units in the Brandon area, 3,068 in the immediate future, 3,572 in the near future, and so on. So it just shows how you would be farming in a different kind of climate, or your kids might be as they entered the business.
So practically speaking, what could a farmer do with this data? How could they change how they farm?
Yeah, well, these are the kinds of variables you make your farm management decisions on right now. The premise here is that agriculture and individual farms can adapt to climate change over time, but not overnight. It requires longer-term thinking, longer-term planning. So what this is called is a tool to assess climate risk to the farm business, as well as opportunities that lie ahead. One of the things the co-directors of the Prairie Climate Center emphasized when they unveiled this agricultural section is that this is information to help farmers plan for both risk and opportunity. There may be new crops that thrive in more heat, but the caveat is precipitation. So there's also a need to find ways to be ready for the likelihood of more frequent conditions of water stress. So therefore, the planning around that is think about how you're going to be managing water on the farm, perhaps finding ways to store some for the times you don't have enough. So to answer your question, Ed, you make informed decisions with information. So farmers could use this for farm planning for either short or long-term transitions to new technologies, new techniques, different types of crops, different types of livestock. Excuse me. There's videos on this new site as well that feature farmers talking about some of the strategies they've already adopted, like rotational grazing and soil management for carbon sequestration. So the bottom line is the business of agriculture is always about figuring out risk exposure and knowing what trajectory you're on. And the Climate Atlas, and this section specifically, was developed to turn information into knowledge so farmers can be thinking about what impact climate change will have on their land and their business and decide what action they want to take or not take as time goes on.
Have you got a link that listeners can run to?
Yeah, it's just climateatlas.ca, climateatlas.ca.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Lorraine.
You're very welcome.
Lorraine Stevenson is a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Ed White. More and more consumers say they don't want artificial ingredients in their food. They don't like seeing complicated, sciencey-sounding things in what they eat. Some companies are producing lines of food that offer consumers the sort of foods they say they want. Maple Leaf Foods did that years ago, but is now taking one radical step further. It's replacing its entire line of products with almost identical products that don't contain the suspected ingredients. I spoke with Maple Leaf Senior Vice President Adam Grogan, and this is some of our discussion.
You know, we just felt it was the right thing to do. I mean, consumers are looking for these types of products. Our products are in households across the country every day. And we just felt like we were going to go all in and make sure that we had a brand that was that could deliver on what they were looking for the future for a very long time. And so we decided that we were going to make that commitment. It's bold and it's ambitious, but you know we feel very strongly that it's the right thing to do for our Canadian consumers.
Grogan told me it hasn't been easy.
I think probably the largest issue that we face is really in this notion of eliminating artificial preservatives. We have a very big country. It's very vast. We need the shelf life in this country to be able to service from coast to coast in an economical way. And so I think probably the area that we feel most proud of is how we've been able to eliminate those artificial preservatives and maintain the shelf life that are required from our consumers. So I would say that that's probably the most advanced work that we've done. So I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at the website, but
yeah, I was there.
Yeah, and you know, in there you can see the ingredient changes and kind of what we went from, you know, things like sodium phosphate and dextrose and sodium ascorbate to essentially cultured celery extract, spices, and, you know, basically it's meat, spices, and heat that we apply for the most extent. And obviously that took a lot of work to make sure that we get that right. And also not only get it right, but that it tastes amazing. I mean, this is obviously consumers, no matter what you put in front of them, they're going to vote with how it tastes first. And I think you're going to find as well that most of the products, or all the products actually for that matter, are taste amazing. And in some cases, we've actually, I think we've made even tastier products with some of this, some of these changes.
Not everything Maple Leaf was making could be converted.
Actually, what I would tell you is that we've also eliminated a number of items in our portfolio. And where we could not include an ingredient that was natural, real, or simple, and you'll find on our website our manifesto.
Yep.
If it could not meet or live up to the manifesto, it was not... it was not launched in the new portfolio. So, as you'll see, everything with new packaging and the new logo design is basically the reference point for consumers to know that now has been converted over to the natural line. But we know one thing is true: is that in this day and age, you know, companies like ours that are feeding Canadians, it's really important that we are 100% open and transparent. Consumers want to know exactly what's in their food. They want the companies that service them to be 100% open and honest and transparent about how they produce that food. And if a product did not live up to that manifesto, it was really important that we put that out there for the Canadian public to know that they would never find an item that did not deliver to that manifesto. And there's some tough choices when you're in that situation along the way.
These sorts of changes have implications for farmers.
You know, I think we're all faced in the value chain, the whole supply chain, all the way back to the farms. This idea of, you know, building trust with consumers and, you know, a commitment to absolute transparency. I mean, more and more with the advent of technology, you know, the reality is that not only there's a great deal of consumers that want to understand where their food comes from. They want to understand how it's produced and tie that with this idea of technology enabling that. I think it's all important for all of us, and I see it, this as being like just one opportunity for us to have, you know, remain committed to that transparency. That's really important to us, and that's certainly advice that I would provide. The other thing is really around, when it comes to production, this notion of making sure that we, animal care is really important. You know, obviously in our business, well, we have a vested interest in making sure the animal is cared for because it ultimately leads to better product. But more and more consumers are demanding knowledge and understanding about making sure that we are really responsible to that animal. And then lastly, it's probably really this notion of environmental impact. I mean, I think we're really fortunate in this country that we have access to the land that we have and a great regulatory system to provide great, you know, great food. But consumers more and more want to make sure that the environmental impact to, you know, air, water, and land is paramount to everyone that's in the supply chain. And so from that standpoint, I know sometimes, you know, our members, you know, our suppliers can sometimes find those types of things very daunting. However, I think they're very important, and I actually think we can all reap the rewards of doing those really, really well.
That's something that's happening in the factories and the grocery stores. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Ed White. Now we turn to something happening, and soon to be happening, on the fields of Western Canada. Robin Booker, the Western producer, joins me now to talk about the challenge of weed control this year. Hi, Robin. So how does this year's challenge compare to the average spring?
Well, in many areas of the prairies, cold weather hung around until Then all of a sudden, bang, the warm weather was here. So the cold weather hung around a lot longer than it normally does. And what that might mean is that there could be a compressed emergence period for many of the weed species that would normally be emerging throughout the early part of the growing season.
And yeah, I know some guys will think of using a pre-emergent rather than a burn down. That can bring some risks, right?
Yeah, I talked to Charles Brunzel, and he said that there is risks of skipping the burn down. He said by the time growers come in with their in-crop weed control, there could be weeds that are very large, and those large weeds are the ones that provide the most competition to the crop. He suggests growers should proceed as they normally would any other year, including using a burn down. And there's also a risk that growers who decide on a pre-emergence herbicide over a pre-seed burn down, that they could get caught by wet weather and they just can't get on the field to deal with the weeds later on.
And some guys might be tempted to broadcast fertilizer in this kind of a situation where timing and field conditions are a bit of a challenge. What's the possible problem there?
Brenzel said that, you know, weeds are actually oftentimes better scroungers for nutrients than the crop is. So that if you're just broadcasting it and if you're dealing with some weed issues, that you might just be fertilizing the weeds.
And in some parts of Alberta, they've got the opposite problem of the very dry prairies, which is what a lot of people are dealing with. In some of those areas, they actually have overland flooding. And what is their particular challenge going to be this year?
Well, they just can't get on the field or many parts of the field. And the latest Alberta crop report suggests that there are going to be some unseeded acres there because of the flooding. And what Getty suggests is that instead of just doing a chem follow, that growers might think of putting down a cover crop, or if they're in an area with livestock, putting in some barley silage to just sort of suppress the weeds, because these crops are very efficient at suppressing weeds and there's less potential for selection for herbicide resistance.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Robin.
Thank you.
Robin Booker is a reporter with the Western Producer. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Ed White. And now we turn to the markets. On Friday, Statistics Canada released its grain and oilseed stocks report for this spring. Dave Sims of Commodity News Service joins us now to explain how that affected the markets. Hello, Dave, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Oh, hey, Ed. Good to be here.
So how did the report affect canola?
Well, StatsCan came out with the report, and I think it surprised a few people with it. Canola supplies in Canada were pegged around 9.1 million tons, which was the second highest amount on record, but still below what some analysts were expecting. For what we're hearing, a lot of the stocks they found were on the farm and not so much in commercial hands. So the July contract on the charts, where most of the trading is focused right now for canola, it dropped a bit when the report came out, but you know, then the bargain hunters quickly stepped in, so the price didn't really plunge or anything. And I think the report just confirmed what a lot of traders had suspected heading in. So, you know, a lot of the weakness was already baked into the market to begin with. A few other features, I guess. So large funds were kind of sitting on their hands, and they still are a bit. So the volumes in the market were extremely low. And, you know, the market for canola has been pretty well locked in a range of $525 to $535 per ton since around late February. And this report did nothing to change that.
And where can canola go from here?
Yeah, that's what everyone's wondering. I mean, the dryness in Western Canada is definitely helping to prop up prices right now. We're getting a touch of rain, but more is going to be needed. Farmers selling slow, which has been bullish. Most farmers and traders I talk to are of the opinion that a lot more canola will get planted than what Statistics Canada predicted a few weeks ago. I think their planting intentions was about 21.4 million acres, but most people think it's going to be higher than that. And we obviously have a large stock situation, so those two things will, you know, weigh on prices as we move forward. And I think the trade dispute between the U.S. and China is obviously going to be a pretty key factor. Like, there's some ideas it could get settled soon, and China definitely seems to have a lot of incentive to do that. Like, they're already importing about as many Brazilian soybeans as they can get their hands on. And from what I've heard, like, they need the U.S. soybeans to kind of make up the rest. because their demand is just so massive. But, I mean, if the two sides can't reach a deal, then in theory, that should be great news for canola exporters. So, you know, I think that's one thing we'll be watching for.
Yeah, you know, despite the stocks and despite, you know, these trade tensions, oil seeds have been gently rising for months now. And I'm just wondering what you think is behind the overall crop market strength out there.
Well, I mean, we definitely have some seasonal buying heading in. And like I said, the dryness in Western Canada is something that I think is worrying some of the large funds a little bit more than what maybe is being talked about. But there's definitely some speculative buying helping keeping the market up. But, you know, as I said, I mean, it's canola is locked in a range right now, 525 to 535, and it seems to like being in there. So I will just have to see what could move it either way.
And what roles are crude oil and corn playing here?
Well, crude oil and corn are often said to be two of the three kings on the market, and gold would be the other one. So when it comes to corn, I've often heard it said that it can influence most of the other agricultural markets. Like, if corn goes up, it'll eventually trickle over to some of the other markets. It just may take a while to do that. And corn, it recently broke above $4 a bushel a few weeks ago, and that was the first time it had done that since July. So, but then a few days ago, it had lost that. It went below that. It went below $4. So I think that could set the stage for some more selling. And when it comes to crude oil, it can have a positive and negative effect on cash flow levels for farmers. Like when we look at the good things, or I guess the bullish things for crude oil, like if the price of crude oil goes down, well, that obviously moves diesel lower, which is good news for producers. But when crude oil goes up, well, it tends to give the markets a lot of juice. So there's just more liquidity for the funds to play with. So that can have a positive cascading effect on buying. But, you know, from the, I guess, the negative or bearish things, like if crude oil goes down, then it can start to slow demand. Like the speculative money is pulled away from the long side, and it has to be repositioned to the short side of the futures for oil. So the end result is a kind of a cascading downward effect that spills into other commodities. And it can be kind of hard to fight that, like when you've got selling pressure that's being advanced by the single largest commodity against the smaller ones. So, you know, if crude oil goes lower in price than some of the large funds, they often have to rebalance their assets and sell things like canola. And, you know, those funds, like often you'll have some funds that like aren't into agriculture at all, but you know, when crude oil's high and there's a lot of juice in the market, well, they'll look around and let's say they see that soy meal is, you know, approaching a price level that they like or whatever. I remember, I think about 2 years ago or maybe less than that, like all of a sudden soy meal was going through the roof and a lot of these outside funds had gotten interested all of a sudden because they thought they could make some money. And so soy meal really jumped. And so, I mean, yeah, crude oil is probably the king on the market, and it can definitely move things either way.
Well, thanks, Dave, for coming on today.
Oh, yeah. No, my pleasure.
Dave Sims is a reporter with Commodity News Service. That's all for this week. Join us again next week for another edition of Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, and I thank you for joining me.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.